Krishna. Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Actually, technically, Krishna means unto Lord Krishna. I'm just giving a little Sanskrit understanding. Like when you said Krishna would be the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Krishna would be unto Lord Krishna. Or like Bhagavan or Bhagavati means unto Bhagavan. Okay. Little Sanskrit information. So, evam, only. Bhagavate, unto him. Manaha, with mind. Vak, speech. Drishti, sight. Ritibhihi, activities. Atmane, unto the Supersoul. Atmanam, the living being. Avesha, having merged in. Technically in Sanskrit, that word means being absorbed in. So you don't misunderstand that Bhishma is actually, he's not merging into the Lord. He's absorbed in the Lord. So technically, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita that word is used, maya vesha mano. Like this, one should absorb one's mind in Krishna. So avesha, technically, it's in the Sanskrit technical definition. Although Prabhupada translates it as merged in, which in Prabhupada's English means the same thing. You're merging your thoughts in or absorbing your thoughts in, which are technically the same thing. Okay? Saha. He. Antasvasaha. Inhaling. Uparamat became silent. So translation, Sutta Goswami said, thus Bhishma Deva merged himself in the Supersoul, Lord Shri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, with his mind, speech, sight, and actions, and thus he became silent and his breathing stopped. So purport by his divine grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. The stage attained by Bhishma Deva while quitting his material body is called Nirvikalpa Samadhi, because he merged himself into thinking of the Lord and his mind into remembering his different activities. He chanted the glories of the Lord, and by his sight he began to see the Lord personally present before him, and thus all his activities became concentrated upon the Lord without deviation. This is the highest stage of perfection. And it is possible for everyone to attain this stage by practice of devotional service. The devotional service of the Lord consists of the nine principles of service activities, and they are 1. Hearing, 2. Chanting, 3. Remembering, 4. Serving the lotus feet, 5. Worshipping, 6. Praying, 7. Executing the orders, 8. Fraternizing, that means being a friend of, and 9. Fully surrendering. Any one of them or all of them are equally competent to award the desired result, but they're required to be practiced persistently under the guidance of an expert devotee of the Lord. The first item, hearing, is the most important item of all, and therefore hearing of the Bhagavad Gita and later on Srimad Bhagavatam is essential for the serious candidate who wants to attain the stage of Bhishma Deva at the end. The unique situation at Bhishma Deva's time of death can be attained, even though Lord Krishna may not be personally present. His words of the Bhagavad Gita or those of Srimad Bhagavatam are identical with the Lord. They are sound incarnations of the Lord, and one can fully utilize them to be entitled to attain the stage of Sri Bhishma Deva, who is one of the eight Vasus. Every man or animal must die at a certain stage of life, but one who dies like Bhishma Deva attains perfection, and one who dies forced by the laws of nature dies like an animal. That is the difference between a man and an animal. The human form of life is especially meant for dying like Bhishma Deva. So, Sutuvacha Krishna evam bhagavati manova drishti vritti bihi atman yatmanam avesha Sontak Shvasa Uparamat. So, Om Aganath, Ramazandra Shah, Gananjana, Silakaya Chakshur, and Miditam, Yena Kurzbai, Shigurave Namaha. So, Grandfather Bhishma is known as one of the Dwarasha Mahajanas, the 12 great personalities. And he was able to attain the stage of remembering Krishna at the time of leaving this material world because he had become free of all what we call anarthas. Anartha means basically unwanted things like lust, anger, greed, illusion, envy, fear. These are the impediments in devotional service. Previously, now this is a very interesting story because previously Bhishma Dev, before he became Bhishma Dev, he had exhibited some anarthas. And he had to learn his lesson during his pastimes as Grandfather Bhishma. So the anartha, or one of the anarthas he exhibited, was very interesting. He was one, as Prabhupada mentions here in the purport, he was one of the heavenly vasus. Actually, vasu means heavenly anyway. So there are eight vasus, and they're great personalities. And he had a particular problem. He was, for lack of offending anybody, I don't want to offend anyone. Anyway, he was controlled by his wife. People should listen to their wives, but you should be controlled by... it's better to be controlled by Shastra and intelligence, basically intelligence. Because we have this... there's the Pancha Mahabhuta, earth, water, fire, air, ether, and then the mind, intelligence, and false ego. So Prabhupada said the intelligence is this close to the super soul. And the mind isn't that close. It's pretty far away. At least the material mind is engaged in what? Accepting and rejecting things according to what pleases us and or what displeases us. That's the mind. But the intelligence, the form direction of the super soul, is based upon... at least spiritual intelligence is based upon the long-term welfare of ourselves or the living entity who utilizes his intelligence. In other words, intelligence means basically I have a vision for my life. Just like in strategic planning, there's a vision statement and a mission statement, right? Anyone who does strategic planning. So what is the mission statement? Mission statement basically is to become Krishna conscious. And so, therefore, we accept and reject things according to whether those things or activities or thoughts meet our goal in life or help us achieve that goal in life. And of course, those are the first two surrendering principles or practices mentioned by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, right? Accept everything favorable, reject everything unfavorable. Very important. And of course, the other ones are to always understand the Lord is maintaining one, to understand the Lord is protecting one, to be meek and humble, and to have no separate interest other than the interest of the Lord. So for this purpose, talking about intelligence, it means to examine things, just like the word Parikshit means the examiner. So we should all be like Parikshit, examining things, whether this fits my particular objective in life. This particular activity that's being proposed, or this particular thought, or this particular place I want to go to, or anything. Everything should be examined with that in mind. So that's the intelligence platform. In the material world, the intelligence platform is in the mode of passion. Everything is examined in terms of what I want to achieve. Like if someone's a good businessman, everything they look at will be utilized somehow or other in the service of making money. Like even if they go to the forest for a vacation, they'll be thinking of selling the trees. You're making some money from the forest. Oh, what can we get from the trees to make money? So because their focus is, what is it, ekeha, as Krishna mentions in the Bhagavad Gita. They're one-pointed. Businessmen are one-pointed. So devotees should be one-pointed too. What is it, ekeha kurunandana. Yavasayatmaka buddhya, ekeha. Kurananda. Those who are on this path are one-pointed and their determination is one. But those who are, let's say, in the mode of ignorance, Because in the mode of goodness and passion, you're pretty determined. But in the mode of ignorance, bahushaktas to anantascha. They have many, many different objectives, just moment to moment, that's the mental platform. Bogaishvarya prasaktanam. Taya pratichetasam. Vyavasayatmaka buhir samado navatiyate. Everybody know this verse? No. Anyway, it's good to learn it. So, that those who are attached to boga and aishvarya, that means sense gratification and opulence, prasaktanam, you're never really going to become determined. Taya pratichetasam, I mean, the mind is never going to be focused. And then, vyavasayatmaka buhir, that one point of determination never occurs with such a person. Samado navatiyate. So anyway, so the intelligence platform means, regardless of what the mind is telling you, and the mind tells us all sorts of things, crazy things, things that are counterproductive for Krishna consciousness, then you just do what the intelligence says. Yes, I have to become Krishna conscious. It doesn't matter what this mind says. You know, we beat the mind with shoes or with a cane or a stick, like Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said. Those of you who have gone to Bhakti Vinod Thakur's house at Radhakund, anyone here who's been there? There's the cane and the shoes from Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And if you're actually fortunate enough, you can ask the pujari to hit you on the head. Anyone's ever had that happen to them? Yeah. You just give him a donation and he takes the cane out and whack, whack, again and again and again. So you're whacked by the cane of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur and you take the dust from the feet or the shoes of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So anyway, so that's talking about the intelligence platform. So one who listens to the mind, basically that's what happened to Grandfather Bhishma when he was Jao, the Vasu in a previous life. He listened to his wife. I'm not saying they shouldn't listen to your wife. Please don't get me wrong. But whatever proposal comes to you, you should examine it with your intelligence. So what happened is that Zhao's wife wanted to get the desire cow that belonged to Vashishtha Muni. And this desire cow, so the reason she wanted to do it is she had a friend who was here on earth. And her friend, a lady friend. And what happens when you're here on earth is that you tend to get a little old. And when you get old, you get wrinkles and your hair starts to recede or turn white. Isn't it? Some of you aren't old enough to understand that. But it will happen to you. You're thinking, not me. He's just talking like that. I'll just always be young. So she had this friend, and the friend had that problem. But the remedy for that problem is not, Botox injections? You know about that? You do that? No. The remedy for the problem is not Botox injection. The remedy is the milk from this cow, the Surabhi cow or the Desire cow. So she wanted to get her friend this particular cow so that there would be some milk and then her friend could be rejuvenated. It's like the fountain of youth. Also in the West, there was this explorer from Portugal. His name was Ponce de Leon. I don't know if anyone's heard of him. He was looking for the fountain of youth. No one's ever heard of this before? Anyway, from Europe, these explorers came to the New World, and they were looking for various things. Like Columbus, he was looking for a way to India, but he found America instead of India. That's why you have the place called the West Indies. You understand? So he didn't actually find his way to India. He found his way to America. And there was this person called Ponce de Leon. He was looking for the Fountain of Youth. He had heard the Fountain of Youth was in a state of the United States called Florida. So he came to Florida to find the Fountain of Youth. And, of course, he didn't find the Fountain of Youth. Nowadays, Florida is more or less a place for old people. Anyway, so the same way, this Surabhi milk, or the milk from the Desire cow, Nandini was her name, the cow's name, is the remedy for old age. And so this lady, Zhao's wife, wanted to get it. And she said to Zhao, you got to get this cow for my friend. And Zhao, being henpecked, You have that word here?
Yes.
Hint it. Nagged, or whatever you call it. He agreed to the whole proposal. He said, all right, let's get it. And then he called his brothers. There were seven brothers. And he said, let's get this cow. So he went and kidnapped the cow. And they were very happy. But Vashishtha Muni, being the great sage as he is, he's a Brahma Rishi, he got very angry and he said to the Vasus, as a result of this great offense, you're going to have to take birth on the earth planet. And of course, they would become the sons of Ganga Devi. And there's a whole other story about that. And the one who is primarily responsible for this, Jao, he will have to live a long life. The rest of you can just go and come. So he has to live a very long life. And not only does he have to, here's the gist of the story, not only does he have to live a long life because he was nagged by his wife in the past, he's not going to get married. So this is the explanation why Grandfather Bhishma had to remain brahmachari. Never heard that one before, right? Because he was nagged by his wife, so you don't deserve a wife in the next life. You have to be a brahmachari and basically be powerless while everybody else is doing their foolishness around you. So this was an interesting lesson for Grandfather Bhishma. So his whole life is a life of lessons, right? Because he's seen, for example, he's seen with the Kurus, primarily Duryodhana, Dhritarashtra, and Duryodhana, and the other 99 Dhritarashtra's sons. So he's seen the results of attachment. Because previously he was attached, and that causes problems. You understand? He was attached, and so now he's seen the results of what happens if someone is so attached to their children that they become blind. He already was blind, but that you just like accept whatever they do as, you know, nectar or important. You contrast that to the story of Maharaj Anga, who had as his son Vena, right? You know that story? There's a story in the Bhagavatam. Maharaj Anga, he had as his son Vena, and he was detached. As soon as Vena started to exhibit his heinous activities, Vena was the person who used to go to with his friends to play, and he would kill all of his friends. His mother would say, what happened to your friends? And Vena would say, I killed them all. Nice kid. And so his father, instead of being attached to him, you know, losing his intelligence, his father said, well, having a child like this is an impetus to renouncing everything. And so he renounced everything and then went to the forest. And Vena became king. Later, Vena was dethroned by the Brahmanas. And as a result, Prithu became king. So you see, I'm contrasting the two stories. Grandfather Bhishma was able to observe this intense attachment that Dhritarashtra had for Duryodhana. And this intense greed. So he's right in front of his face. He's seen the anarthas. It's an interesting lesson, isn't it? That he's seen lust, anger. Look at the anger. Dhritarashtra was filled with anger. And Duryodhana was filled with anger. Lust, anger. We'll just speak of Jayadrath. So many lessons like that. Lust, anger, greed, illusion, envy. Right? So all the anarthas were personified by the Kurus. They were manifest by the Kurus. And so Grandfather Bhishma was learning his lesson that way. And basically, he couldn't do anything about it because he had taken a vow to please his father. His father, of course, was Shantanu. And Shantanu also had been lusting after Satyavati, right? Satyavati, of course, she was the mother also of Srila Vyasadeva. And Shantanu ran into Satyavati. She was taking a boat across the river, taking people across the river, and he fell in love with her, and he became mad. He became mad. And previously, of course, Shantanu had fallen in love with Ganga Devi, and he became so mad that he agreed to whatever she... He agreed to accept whatever she did. Can you imagine that? What is it called? A pre-marital agreement. That whatever I do, you can't argue with me. All you ladies should do that when you get married. Just have the husband sign. You should never argue with me, never disagree with me, and support me in whatever I want to do. So there was another lesson. You know, there was that agreement. So Shantanu had to just sit back while his wife kept throwing the kids in the Ganges, right? And you know, so there was that example of extreme attachment and just listening to one's wife. You know, so contrasting that with Jal listening to his wife. You understand what I mean? So I'm just contrasting these different stories of the Mahabharata. And then there's the example of Shantanu falling in love with Satyavati. And previously he had made the vow that Bhishma would become the next king. He was appointed the crown prince. And so he became so attached to Satyavati that he went into a deep depression. And Bhishma just had to keep asking him, you know, what's the problem, Dad? And finally it was revealed to him by one of the servants of the king that his father was madly in love. So there's another example. Someone who's madly in love, Grandfather Bhishma sees this. He wasn't grandfather at that time, but Devavrat and Bhishma. He saw this, and he understood the dangers of being controlled by one's senses. So throughout one's life, just all these different things happened. He was seeing the anarthas displayed in front of him. And so seeing that, that's a definite wake-up call. And he understands how the anarthas are detrimental to even living nicely in the material world, what to speak of advancing spiritually. So seeing all these things, he took complete shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and became this great Mahajan, Grandfather Bhishma. And he engaged, as Prabhupada mentions here, of course, in the purport, he engaged in the 9 processes of devotional service. He wasn't simply sitting and watching all the nonsense going on in the kingdom and just getting depressed. He took shelter in Krishna consciousness. So that's also a lesson for us, that when we see these things, or when we are subjected to these things, we should take shelter of the 9 processes of devotional service. And each and every one of us has a specific attraction to one or several of the processes of devotional service. Everybody's different. Of course, you have someone like Prithu Maharaj, who performed all 9 processes of devotional service. And Ambarish Maharaj also. He also performed all 9 processes. Savai Manat Krishna Padara Vindaya. So he fixed his mind on Krishna by going to the temple of Krishna, his legs by going to the temple of Krishna, his sense of touch by touching the lotus feet of the devotees and serving the devotees, etc. As far as these 9 processes of devotional service are concerned, there are specific acharyas or exemplars of these 9 processes. For example, hearing. Does anyone know the primary example that Prabhupada gives and the acharyas give of someone who is... Who is that? Who? Pariksit Maharaj. And then as far as chanting, who? Sukadeva. Hearing, chanting, and remembering. Starts with a P. Prahlad Maharaj. Because Prahlad Maharaj was engaged in being attempted torture by his father. Hearing, chanting, remembering, and then Padasevanam, serving the lotus feet. Lakshmi. Hanuman's later on. And then Archanam. Kutumaraj also did Archanam. Akro was prayers, Vandanam. Vandanam and Dasham. Here's Dasham. You answered that before. Hanuman. Sakyam. Arjuna and Atmani Vedanam. Bali Maharaj. He was the one as the Acharya of the Atmani Vedanam. Surrendering everything to the lotus feet of the Lord. So the point is, when these anarthas arise, even within ourselves or within others, then we should take shelter of these things. Then immediately, that's our real shelter. It's like the word used here in the verse is merged in, avesha. So that means to be absorbed in or to be fixed in. These are different definitions of the word avesha. So that we should run to that. Instead of taking shelter, you know, when these things happen, unfortunate things happen in this world, and Krishna definitely has arranged this world so unfortunate, painful, horrible things happen. Instead of taking shelter in mundane lamentation or in anger, sometimes we take shelter in anger too. You know, how can this happen to me? You know, I'm a devotee. How can Krishna do this to me? Then we get angry with Krishna, we're angry with someone else. Or we start lamenting, feeling sorry for ourselves. Oh, I'm so miserable, I'm very miserable. Let me tell you how miserable I am. We go around to everyone else, you know, can I tell you how miserable I am, Sajjana? You know, just, oh, everyone, no one loves me. You know, what was that called? The genre of music, the blues. You've heard of the blues before? Is that typical? You know, singing the blues. Instead, we just, that's my experience, is that when something painful happens in this world, I mean, my personal response is I go take a long japa walk. Instead of just sitting there in the room and just like getting, you know, anxiety, intense, depressed. You know, things painful do happen to all of us. Not only Grandfather Bhishma. I mean, look what happened to him. I mean, he had to fight with his favorite grandson, Arjuna. He had to see the dynasty completely, you know, dissolved. He had to see so many people die. So many stresses he was subjected to. So his lesson in his life was to take shelter of the nine processes of devotional service, which he was successful in. Similarly, we should be doing that too. Whenever there's something happen, even if something doesn't happen, but Krishna specifically arranges things to happen. Yashaham anugrinameyu harishe tadhanam shanai. Krishna specifically arranges things to happen, so we will do that. An easy life and Krishna consciousness don't go well together. If everything goes well in our lives, everyone agrees with us, everybody smiles, everyone loves us, we have plenty of money, we never get sick, it's not so good. It's not so good for Krishna consciousness. So you have, as we mentioned the other day, you have devotees like Queen Kunti who ask for more miseries. Isn't it? Tatra tatra, Jagat Guru, she says. Again and again, send these miseries. We shouldn't, Prabhupada said we should not pray like that for more miseries. But Krishna is perfectly capable of sending enough without us asking for more. Right? And we don't need to say, Krishna, please make me eat. Yeah, anyway, you get the idea. So, so that's the whole point of Aisha. To be absorbed because we've come to the understanding that there is no happiness in this world. And we see, unless someone comes to that understanding, they really can't be enthusiastic in Krishna consciousness. Unless they're convinced that there's no happiness. If we're still thinking, we're still hopeful, then our determination will not be it. Because that's the same thing. Bhogashwari prasatanam tayar pratichetasam. Yavasayatmaka buddhir, tamado navadhire. The same verse I quoted from the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. If one still has the hope for bhoga, aishwarya, or even liberation, bhukti mukti siddhi, calm. Any of those things, then they can't be determined anymore. So Krishna is arranging our lives, so just like he arranged the life of Grandfather Bhishma, to bring him to the point of being avesha, absorbed in Krishna consciousness. So, any questions or comments? I'm not going to speak for a long time, but we'll take some questions. It's interesting. I find it quite interesting that because Bhishma's problem came about because he listened to his wife, he was cursed to not have any wife. Isn't it interesting? And then watch everybody else have problems. Yes.
So why didn't Vishnu chastise Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra?
He did. He did, but he had to listen to them because he took a vow. See, that's another point. That because he wanted to facilitate his father. He was so loyal to his father that he wanted to facilitate Shantanu in marrying Satyavati. He took a vow not to become the king, not to be married, and also to adhere to whatever the king or the emperor said. Be completely loyal. So that was his promise. It's interesting. I mean, if you examine different understandings of culture, In those particular days, like Grandfather Bhishma's days, the vow was considered important, and the results of that vow were considered secondary to keeping the vow. It's quite interesting. It's a different system of morality. Whereas Krishna's system is, the results of the activity are the important thing. The thing itself can be adjusted, even if you've taken a vow, because he advised Yudhisthira Maharaj to lie. So in other words, Krishna was considering the results of an action important, more important than the action itself, whereas Grandfather Bhishma considered the action important and the results were secondary. So he learned, that's another lesson Grandfather Bhishma learned throughout those pastimes. So Grandfather Bhishma had taken this vow, and he stuck to his vow even when it wasn't good for the society. That was a mistake. That is definitely a mistake. Because promises, even though we don't want to advocate that people break their promises, promises should be broken when, let's say, someone is in danger and you can save them. Or you can tell a lie. Let's say some dacoits come to your house and they're looking for you, Ananda, so, right? You know, somehow or other, you know, they've been following you from India, you know, they want to kill you or something. And they come to the door of the house and they knock on the door and they say, "Hello." And I say, "Hello." And they say, "Is Ananda here?" And I cannot tell a lie, he's here. And then they come in and they kill you. That's pretty crazy. So instead, I would lie. I would say, "He's not here. I haven't seen him. I don't even know who you're talking about." That's what I would say. And so I would tell a lie, which is against certain aspects or principles of Dharma, in order to save your life. But Grandfather Bhishma, he had this misunderstanding, which he learned later on that it wasn't proper to do that because he saw Krishna breaking his promise. He saw Krishna encouraging others to lie. He saw Krishna being super tricky in the battle for etc., just so they could win. I mean, Krishna pulled so many tricks. He vowed not to interfere or fight, yet he grabbed the chariot wheel. He made it appear like the sun was going down one day, so that Arjuna could kill Jayadrath. He tricked Duryodhana to wearing something in his midriff, so that he wasn't invulnerable in the midriff. I mean, he just goes through the whole battle, Kurukshetra. I mean, Krishna was super tricky. You know, breaking all the rules. But the primary rule of doing what is best, he didn't break. So Grandfather Bhishma, the point is that Grandfather Bhishma did talk to Duryodhana. And he was so attached to his vow, here's another thing, that he didn't say anything when there was the attempted disrobing of Draupadi. Maybe said something, but he didn't interfere. Can you imagine? He allowed the most horrible activity to take place, and he just sat there. Maybe frustrated, but he just sat there because he was so attached to that vow. So which is more important, keeping your promise or protecting Draupadi? He didn't understand that. At the end, he did. After going through it, he had a lot of lessons to learn. That's the point I'm making. That the pastimes, the activities, what Bhishma came in contact with throughout his life were all lessons for him. It's not just that it happened and it's just some play, you know, the Mahabharata is really interesting, Bhishma is a tragic character. It's not like that. There were reasons why he specifically had to undergo those particular experiences. And there are reasons why we specifically, I'm relating that to our lives, have to undergo some specific experiences. And some of them are not so pleasant. Right? I mean, whether it's health problems, or whether it's, you know, people we have to interact with on a daily basis that are really driving us crazy. You know, we all have these little burdens to bear, so to speak, in our lives. I think everybody has that. Isn't it? I mean, can anyone say that they're free from unpleasant things happening in their lifetimes? Anybody here? Anybody's life has just been like one bowl of cherries? Did you ever hear that expression before? Life is a bowl of cherries? No, that's an American expression.
Isn't that why we are born again?
Yeah, we're born again to undergo experiences. And these experiences, it's like school. And why does a teacher teach you something? Because you have to learn something in a specific grade. So devotional service or advancement in devotional service is a multi-life experience. So we're here to learn more. We didn't learn enough in the last life. We didn't learn that lust, anger, and greed wasn't so great for us. So now we have to go through it again. And then next life, we don't learn this life. Guess what? See you again. The next life, it'll be there with more lessons. Therefore, it's better to graduate, right? And not have to go back to school. So Bhishma was definitely in school, learning certain things that Krishna wanted him to learn. Otherwise, previous life, he hadn't learned those things. So you have some questions?
So like the difficulties, you know, we accept are there, but even in devotional service, we tend to endeavor to make our devotional service comfortable.
Yeah.
So, you know, so the endeavor is rather in the making the situation comfortable rather than doing the devotional service that time. Mm. And we have something to say.
Yeah, well, it also depends on how advanced we are in Krishna consciousness. In the beginning, we dovetail things, and as Prabhupada said, whatever you're doing before, do it for Krishna. And, you know, Krishna sort of, there's this expression, Krishna tightens the screws as you advance in devotional service. So in the beginning, yeah, we dovetail, you know, if I was a taxi driver, I'll drive a taxi for Krishna or something like that. And, but as we advance, we have to be ready to do anything that Krishna wants. In the beginning, there's varnashram, engaging according to our psychophysical nature. Krishna is much softer with the new devotees than he is with the older devotees. Therefore, it's better not to advance in devotional service. Better remain a neophyte, and things are a lot easier. But yeah, Krishna's like that. I mean, what he did with Queen Kunti, I don't think any of us would tolerate that. Or with the Pandavas, or any of these things. And so what to speak of with the gopis in Vrindavan, Krishna left. And that's so intense, how Krishna left after 16 years, and they were in pain the rest of their pastimes, the rest of their existence there. So, let's say, our business, when we're helping people and be Krishna conscious, we should try to make things comfortable for them. So how's that? As comfortable, that's the business of a leader. That you make things comfortable for people engaged in Krishna consciousness. But for ourselves, we have to understand our level of advancement. If we try to accept too much discomfort, it could actually discourage us from Krishna consciousness. Like if I try to imitate the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, eat a pat of butter every 2 days, and no more carob pie at night, then it's, you know, I don't think I'll be too happy. So, I think we have to understand practically our own level of advancement and not accept more than we're ready to accept at this particular point, understand our needs. Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Chaitanya Shikshamrita says that we have basic physical human needs that have to be fulfilled if we're going to progress in a stable or steady way in Krishna consciousness. So it really requires some intelligence, understanding, you know, that we do need some comfort. You know, not just to reject it and imitate artificially great personalities. So it's a complicated thing to understand. So it's all right, you know, if you need a bed to sleep on, don't sleep on the floor. I remember when we first joined the movement, nobody had beds. Everybody just slept on the floor. Some devotees didn't even use mats, or they just had like a straw mat on the floor. And I thought it was more advancement in devotional service to sleep like that. So I tried it, and then I had sores all over my body the next morning, so didn't sleep very well. So it wasn't so practical. So yes, if you need comfort, yeah, whatever you need. And we shouldn't criticize someone because they need more comfort than we need. You know, someone may need a softer bed. And that's how, don't criticize them. That's just their needs. You know, so, you know, I may be a sannyasi. Someone may need to be married. That's fine. That's their needs. That's their situation. We shouldn't decry someone else's needs. Okay? You have another question?
Yes. The previous verse, Vishmadev verse, says, now I have transcended the misconceptions of duality in regard to his presence in everyone's heart. Can you elaborate on that
one? Yeah. Well, basically duality, just like this is relating to the Bhagavad Gita, then an understanding in the mode of passion means to see different living entities in different bodies, you know, as different substances, vastus. So that's an understanding the mode of goodness is to see one underlying spiritual nature. So here Krishna, Grandfather Bhishma, it's speaking of how he's achieved the mode of goodness, is seeing the one underlying spiritual dynamic in each and every body. That's basically it. Duality means there's to be differences because of the body. It doesn't mean that you transcend duality and become a monist and see everybody is the same. You know, we're all one. I'm you, you're me, I'm God, you're God, we're all God. Thank God. So that's not what transcending duality. Transcending duality means to see the one underlying spiritual nature, and that's what he says in regard to his presence in everyone's heart. In other words, to see everybody as being connected to Krishna, and everyone to have the same spiritual nature. Seeing everybody equal. Was it Yastu Sarvani Bhutane Atmane Vanapashati Sarvabhuteshu Chatmanam Tato Nabhigagupshate? Does anyone know that verse? Where does that come from? It's this Upanishad. Yastu Sarvani Bhutane. One who sees Sarvani Bhutani, all living entities, Atmane Vanu Pashati. Pashati means to see. That they're all of the same nature and we're all connected. Sarvabhuteshu, there's all living entities, Chatmanam, in the heart, in the self. Katona Vigupshate will not hate anyone. That's Isupanishad verse. And that means also, not only not hate anyone, that also means not thinking that someone is connected with me special because they're family members or something like that. In other words, see all living entities equally. You love equally the cockroach in the same way that you love a cuddly little animal. You know, people get pets like what, cats or dogs or something like that, because the pets are cuddly. You know that word, cuddly? That means they have nice fur on them. Where I've very rarely seen someone with a pet cockroach. Have you? I see people with pet snakes though. So and scorpions. But so in other words, to see all living entities equally. Not in terms of family attachment, not in terms of how they please me or displease me, but that's that Yastu Sarvani Bhutani. In other words, we're all parts and parcels of Krishna, Mamivam Sajiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. So we're all parts and parcels of Krishna, and basically, basically that means we're all brothers and sisters. That's true brotherhood. True, you know, sisterhood, true equality of all living entities. So that's what Bhishma is referring to here. That he's transcended this concept that this is my family or these are mine, I and mine. And he's come to the concept of understanding all living entities are part and parcel of Krishna. Yeah. Everyone equally sees everything in me. I am never lost to him, nor is he ever lost to me. Yeah, same thing. That's the same thing. So duality means mode of passion. And that, it doesn't mean just two. Duo means two, but it means to see differences. That's right. To see differences between different living entities because of their body or because of their relationship with me. Like if I consider, you know, my family members more important than others, that's duality. You know, I and mine. That's a, you know, the two divisions of material consciousness. I and mine. My family, I like this. Does that make sense? Anyway, some philosophy. Yeah.
Maharaj, during when we have difficult times in our life, sometimes it can seem like the mind just takes over and gets pulled up with anxiety or grief or worries, and it's really hard.
It is.
Because like those things, standing 16 rounds and just trying to drag my mind back on to hearing, and my mind is just. It just seems like it's taking over. It's just full of anxiety. So what is the best way to just switch off on the mind and take?
Well, I tell you what I do. I mean, I give you my own personal experience. I don't just sit there and chant. I take a walk, and an aerobic walk. Because when you're in anxiety, there's a physiological constituent to that anxiety. I mean, there's a release of all these different... The doctor can tell us all these different interesting things. And what's that?
Adrenaline.
Yeah, all this, adrenaline is released. And your kidneys or the adrenal glands on top of the kidneys are producing all these things. So you're in a state, physiologically, you're in a state where it's very hard to concentrate. And so what I find is that, physiologically, this is just my own experience, I'm not presenting this as a Shastric thing. Physiologically, the best way to deal with that is to do something physical, to take a walk, and an aerobic walk, and chant at the same time. So when that happens to me, I'll take a walk for several hours and disappear and chant, 64 rounds or something like that. And by the time I'm finished with 64 rounds, I'm in ecstasy. And I've forgotten what was the disturbing thing. I'm just so happy. And that my experience is that when I take shelter of the holy names in such a way, is that I, after doing this, I actually thank Krishna for doing the thing, whatever he did. In the beginning, I'm sort of like, why did Krishna, why did you do this? Just like, huh. This is so intense. And when I'm finished, I said, thank you, Krishna. Wow, you did it for my own good. So that's my personal experience. And, of course, other things people can do is just get involved in a big Harinam or something. But usually, my experience is if you just sit in the room and with the four walls and try to chant when you've had some intense experience, it's kind of hard. So it's better to get out and either take a walk or have a big kirtan with other devotees or something like that, that really takes your consciousness or mind. This is a practical hint how to do that. Does that make sense? I find walking myself very helpful. Very, very helpful. Especially if I'm in Govardhan, then I walk around Govardhan. It's so nice when you stay at Govardhan. Actually, the whole purpose of going to the Holy Dham is to increase your hearing and chanting, rather than just going sightseeing. Sightseeing may be interesting. Just like Prabhupada, when he was in Vrindavan with his spiritual master on the Braj Mando Parikrama, there was the announcement that there was a temple of Shiradakshai Vishnu. Actually, I saw that temple. It's an interesting temple. And the devotees would be going that night to see the deities there. And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was going to be staying back and talking. So just about everybody went out to see the deities, right? The whole crowd went, Jai, we're going to go see Shiradakshai Vishnu. And there is a beautiful deity there. He's lying with all the demigods around him. Anyone's been to that temple? In Braj? Yeah, you've been to that temple, right? That he's lying there with all the deities, or Lord Brahma, all the demigods around him, and there's the lake, the Shira Lake, right there, right next to him. It's beautiful. So, but Srila Prabhupada decided to stay back with his guru and just hear. And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was very pleased. He said about Prabhupada, he likes to hear. And that was perhaps the greatest praise a guru can give to his disciple. He likes to hear. And so the Prabhupada liked to hear, and he liked to hear so much that he took the order of his spiritual masters, his life and soul, more than any of his godbrothers, and came to the Western world and saved all of us. So, anyways, so hearing this. Hearing, so when you go to a holy place, the point I was making is, the most important thing is hearing and chanting, rather than sightseeing. And that's so absorbing. I mean, if you sightsee, sometimes it just agitates the mind. So what are you going to see? And then, and plus, when you go to all these places, in the holy places, people tell you stories, and you don't even know if the stories are bona fide. He says, Krishna did this here. And then if you ask the person, how do you know? Your tour guide will say, well, that's what people have told me. But basically, we should know things because that's what we've heard from our spiritual master, not just because some villagers told us that Krishna there danced in this specific way. So it's hearing is the most important thing. Shushusro Shradanadesha Vasudeva Kata Ruchi Shan Mahat Sevya Vipra Punyatirtha and the Shavana. So I find when I go to the holy places rather than sightseeing. Of course, if devotees come to visit me, I'll take them on a sightseeing tour, because I know all the places. However, personally, if I'm there, the most enjoyable thing for me is just to be absorbed in Krishna's names. And it's so nectarian. I mean, when you chant 64 rounds in a day, it's wonderful. I mean, my realization last time I was at Govardhan was that 16 rounds means you're just getting warmed up. So I put something on the internet like that, my Facebook page. My realization is that, you know, that means you're just starting your rounds, 16 rounds. It's not really chanting your rounds, 16 rounds. It's just starting it. But really, we're supposed to be chanting one lakh of names a day. One lakh is 64 rounds, for those of you who don't know. One lakh is 100,000. 100,000 names. There's 16 names within the Maha Mantra. And if you do all the division, multiplication, everything like that, you come up to 64 rounds as 100,000 names of God. And that's nectar. You don't understand how nice it is. Anyone here ever chant 64 rounds? Yeah, some of you chant 64. It's really wonderful. And you're thinking, 64 rounds, it'll take me 8 hours. What will I do? You know, how will I eat? You can still eat, no problem. Prasadam will taste better. So, any other questions or comments?
Just one thing to share, Maharaj.
Mm-hmm.
So, while we were in Vrindavan, we were listening to one of the Swamis, whose name is Satinandan.
Oh, he's very nice, yeah.
And he always does retreats and all that. And one of his lectures, somebody asked him that when we are chanting and we do anxieties or some problems, our mind is running away. Mm-hmm. So he said the best way for that is you just keep a diary. Mm-hmm. And you just write down whatever anxiety, whatever your mind is going after.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep them, and you just leave them there and say, I will tackle with those problems later. Then I start thinking. And I find it is very, very useful.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, I know one of my other godbrothers, Mukunda Maharaj, did that when I was with him. He keeps a little booklet. Something bothers him while he's chanting, he writes it down. So he notes that he can deal with it later. Yeah, so that's a practical way to deal with it. You know, so you know you have that thing to deal with it, you're not going to forget it, and then you can deal with it later. Good suggestion. Yeah, he gives these nice jobs. Satchinanda Maharaj gives nice retreats at Govardhan and other places. So any other questions? It's getting late because we have to do our Didi Puja and everything. So we want to thank everyone for coming and listening so attentively. All glories to His Divine Grace. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai. Srimad Bhagavatam 1:9:43. Mm-hmm.